What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Howdy, welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. It's the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you are a non-Catholic, perhaps you were a Catholic, a practicing Catholic, that is, many years ago, but you've stepped away for whatever reason, maybe you've never been a Catholic. We would love to hear from you if you have a question or two about the Catholic faith. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're listening to us outside of North America, please dial the U.S. country code and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 55000. Wait for our response and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. And of course, you can send us an email anytime, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Alrighty, Charles Beery is our producer. Michael Birchfield is a guest phone screener today. Glad to have him on board for that. And Jeff Burson is on social media. So if you're watching us today on YouTube or Facebook, you can certainly pose a question there via the comments section. Jeff will pass that on to us here in Studio One. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
Very well. How was your weekend, my friend?
It was adequate.
Adequate?
It was adequate.
In the year 2020, adequate is the new good.
Right.
It is. It just is. All right, we're going to lead off here with an email from Alice, who says, I have a daughter entering her second year in college. She has two good friends from high school who have become very involved with a group called Young Life at their college. One of these boys is from our home parish, who was born and raised Catholic. These two young men seek out my daughter often for, quote, Bible studies, which seem to me more like, why should she become a Calvinist, rather than authentic study. Now, I've heard you many times on EWTN. I know you have many articles we can read. Can you help us find a solid foundation to start with when she meets with these boys? And what articles do you have that we could read? We kind of need a roadmap for how to proceed. Also, should she continue meeting with them, or would it be more prudent to not meet with them? They don't really seem open to hearing her point of view, as they are at the ready with so many scriptures to take her down so many rabbit trails of thought. Thank you, Alice.
Yeah, thanks, Alice. I really appreciate the question. So let me recap here, summarize.
Okay.
Your daughter's got friends from high school that are now very involved in Young Life campus ministry, and they are proselytizing her and attempting to basically persuade her out of her Catholic faith into Calvinism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what do I think about that? I'll tell you a little story.
Okay.
Okay. When I was probably about 24 years old, maybe 25, I was preparing to take the GRE graduate record exam for PhD studies in Reformation Church history and theology. And I met a Catholic girl in a GRE prep class that I was taking at the time. And, I don't know what she was studying. Could have been sociology, could have been English, could have been math. I don't know what she was into. And she said, what are you studying? And I said, I'm studying church history. And she kind of lit up and said, oh, that's pretty interesting stuff. 10 minutes later, I had led her to more or less abandon her Catholic faith.
Wow.
Took me about 10 minutes, right? And the reason why is I pitched to her some pretty standard Protestant evangelical lines about if you died tonight, do you know for sure you'd go to heaven? And do you have a personal relationship with Jesus? And I used a lot of verbiage that she was unfamiliar with, and I quoted a lot of Bible verses, and I lined them up, and it was like shooting fish in a barrel because she hadn't been well catechized in her Catholic faith, and she was kind of a sucker for my presentation. And I take it, looking back on the experience, that she probably did not have an adequate Catholic spirituality. Not only did she not have good catechesis, but she didn't have a deeply connected relationship to her Catholic faith. And so, any Tom, Dick, or Harry with a Bible who could walk his way around the New Testament could manipulate her. And I'm very sorry for that. And if she's listening, you have my heartfelt apologies. If you remember that incident, I don't even remember her name anymore. All that is to say that Catholics that are not well-grounded in their faith, either theologically or spiritually, can be easily manipulated by people who make a persuasive pitch for a moving emotional relationship to Jesus, or a persuasive theological argument. So that's their goal, in my judgment, is to manipulate and proselytize your daughter. Now, whether she's up for that challenge and can charitably and lovingly respond to them in ways that would challenge them out of their, you know, ideological possession, that's another question. She would be perfectly within her rights to say, look, I'd be happy to play tennis with you guys, but I feel like you're trying to proselytize me, and I'm not interested in that. So if that's what relationship to Jesus means to you, it means you have to browbeat people and compel them through argument to try to change religious traditions, I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in growing to know Christ more deeply in my own Catholic faith. Thank you very much. And if she's not familiar with the Fellowship of Catholic University Students, FOCUS, if they're present on her campus or a nearby one, it's a ministry I would really strongly encourage her to get involved in that. Also, and of course, her local Newman Center, and to really jump in with both feet and engage and get catechized in her Catholic faith.
Very good.
Now, if she really wants to engage these people, what she needs to do is not even get into this tit-for-tat business about this verse says this and this verse says that. She needs to throw the whole methodology back in their face and say, two things. First of all, well, is this the way that Christ wants for us to come to know him? Like, did Jesus just send us a book and say, go figure it out with exegetical argument, right? Is that how we're supposed to come to know Christ? Okay, what's your evidence for that if you believe that Jesus gave us this as his rule of faith? Where did Jesus ever say that? Where did Jesus ever tell us, if you have questions about me or the church or the life with God or the moral life, that you are to consult these 66 books? Where's that list given by divine inspiration? Nowhere. Nowhere. It's a Protestant tradition that's how we have to come to know God. Christ gave an entirely different rule of faith. He gave us the teaching church, to whom he said, whatever you bind on earth is bound in heaven, and I'll be with you to the end of the age. So I'm going to stick with the rule of faith founded by Christ. Thank you very much.
That should do it. Hopefully, anyway. Hey, Alice, thank you so much for your email. By the way, if you would like to send us an email for a future show, we'd love to hear from you. The address, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. All right, busy phones already. We're going to lead off here in just a moment with Tom in Twinsburg, Ohio. Also, Dan in Dubuque, Iowa. Got a couple lines open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anderson, 833-288-3986. The Monday edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Do stay with us. Here on EWTN, we believe in the holy sacrifice of the Mass. That's why we broadcast it not only every day at 8 a.m. Eastern on radio and television, but also every 2 hours on EWTN Radio Essentials. It's a station that provides your Catholic needs 24/7. Do check it out at 8 a.m., 10 a.m., 12 noon, 2 p.m., 4 p.m., all the way up through 10 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio Essentials. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders, here on EWTN's Call to Communion. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-3986. Here is Tom to lead us off in Twinsburg, Ohio. Hey there, Tom. What's on your mind today?
Is the pregnancy termination permitted in ectopic pregnancies?
Yes. Thank you for the question. So when you have an ectopic pregnancy and it seems that the life of the mother is in danger and there's no way to save the life of the child, right? I mean, the child is going to die no matter what. The mother is in danger of death. It is permitted to perform certain procedures that will save the life of the mother and will hasten the death of the child, but that do not specifically target the fetus for destruction.
Mm.
And that's an important distinction. And Catholic moral theologians and even hospital chaplains and so forth who are involved in these decisions are very careful about how they specify the procedure. So the doctor is not permitted to go in and directly intentionally kill the fetus, because that would be murder, right? That's intending the death of an innocent person in order to bring about a good result. And we can't ever do that. It's consequentialism. We can't do something that we know is intrinsically wrong in order to bring about a better result. You know, for example, you remember the I'm trying to think of the Tom Cruise movie where they have technology that can foresee crimes. You remember? And there's a police force that goes out there and starts arresting people before they've committed crime.
What was that?
I forgot the title, but you know what I'm talking about, right?
I bet Jeff Burson knows.
Yeah, he knows. He knows. So that'd be intrinsically immoral, right? You know, well, you look to me like you're going to offend, so I'm going to take you out now. No, I'd prevent, maybe, prevent a lot of evil.
Minority Report.
That's the one, exactly. All right. You can't do that. You know, you can't. Well, you might have information on the next terrorist attack, so I'm going to torture you mercilessly and see if I can prevent a terrorist attack.
Yikes.
It might work, but it's not moral. You can't do it. Mm-hmm. You can't do it. All right, you can't intentionally do evil, even to bring about a good result. However, you can do a good thing that has an undesired bad consequence. And in this case, what I'm doing is I am performing a procedure, the doctor's performing a procedure, intending, the aim of the procedure is to save the life of the mother. It has the unintended, undesired consequence of hastening the otherwise inevitable death of the fetus. That procedure is permitted. The direct intentional killing of the fetus is not.
All right. Very good. And we thank you so much for your call, Tom. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. My thanks to Jeff Burson for jumping in with that movie title. He knew it immediately.
I knew he did.
Oh, absolutely.
I got the poster in my head. I can see Tom Cruise's face in my mind. Yeah. I just couldn't think of the title of the film.
Gotcha. Let's go now to Michael. Michael is in Lynn, Massachusetts, watching on EWTN television. Hey there, Michael. What's on your mind today?
I was wondering what a glorified body is.
Yeah, thanks. So, appreciate the question. The best way we have to understand the nature of the glorified body is to look at the post-resurrection appearances of Christ, right? And we know that it's a real body because Jesus can eat and drink after he's been raised from the dead. He can appear to his disciples. Thomas can put his hands in the wounds in Christ's side and in his hands. So it's a real physical body. It has mass. It has extension in space. Real body. All right. It has digestive tract and everything. But it seems to be unlike a real body in other ways. So it vanishes, you know, pops away and comes back, goes through walls, ascends into heaven. At times, the identity of Christ is invisible to disciples, like on the road to Emmaus. So they don't recognize him. And then in the breaking of the bread, suddenly, poof, their mm-hmm. eyes are open. He becomes identifiable mm-hmm. to them. So there's a quality about Christ's resurrected body that's very different, while at the same time not ceasing to be material. And St. Paul talks about that in 1 Corinthians 15. He says, it's real flesh, but it's qualitatively different kind of flesh in the same way that, like, you know, fish and beef are both flesh, but they're qualitatively different.
Sure.
You know, fish, beef, human, resurrected.
Okay. Appreciate that. And Michael, thank you so much for your call. It's Call to Communion here on EWTN. A couple lines open at the moment, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. A text here from Amanda who says, we say in every Mass that Jesus will come back to judge the living and the dead. Well, if this is true, then how are people in heaven and hell already?
Yeah, thanks. So there's two judgments. There's two judgments. The particular judgment that you receive in your soul immediately at the point of death determines your ultimate destiny, whether you go to heaven, hell, purgatory. That's immediately by Christ at your death. But then there's a public final judgment, and its publicity is of the essence of the thing, that it's not privately between the soul and God, but it's in a public forum so that God can be vindicated in the sphere in which he was dishonored. He's vindicated internally, interiorly, in the internal sphere, right, by that immediate particular judgment, but also in the public forum, in front of everybody. And just as the wicked are condemned, the righteous are vindicated as well. And this is a big part of it, right? Because even today, and especially today, we see the righteous persecuted by the wicked. And so one of the purposes of the final judgment is not just that the righteous person goes to heaven when he dies, but that in the very face of the one who persecuted him, God says, you guy on the right, come in. You on the left, out because you beat up on this guy over here, and he forgave you, and you didn't forgive him, so he's in, you're out. And the church actually participates in that judgment, even to the extent of participating in the judgment of the fallen angels. St. Paul says that we will judge angels. That's part of the glory of the church, that we get to pronounce the verdict on of guilty on the evil angels that have spent our whole lives tormenting us.
Wow. Okay, and thank you so much, Amanda, for your text. It's called to communion here at EWTN. We have three lines open right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Here is Dan now in Dubuque, Iowa, listening on EWTN television, a first-time caller. Hi, Dan. What's on your mind today?
I believe that since every priest is backed up spiritually by Jesus in all the seven sacraments of the church, and especially in the holy sacrifice of the Mass, where his body, blood, his soul, divinity is still there, does that also mean that when Jesus backs up a priest in the confession, that his actual blood drips on the sinner and his blood washes away the sin?
Thanks. I appreciate the question. So that would be a powerful metaphor to understand what is essentially a spiritual transaction in the order of grace, right? I mean, the mode of Christ's bodily presence in the Eucharist is in a substantial mode and a sacramental mode and a miraculous mode. And obviously, if I consume the precious blood or eat the Lord's body and blood in the sacred host, it's not dripping down my flesh, and it's not through the medium of physical washing that I am cleansed, even less so in the other sacraments where Christ's passion is presented to us, but without his substantial presence as he is in the Eucharist. So we use this language of the blood of Christ washing us and purifying us and so forth because it's biblical imagery, and it's drawn especially from the sacrificial rites of the Old Testament when the Hebrews would literally kill bulls and literally place blood on their bodies. But the blood of Christ atones for our sin in a different manner, right? It's the blood that Christ shed in martyrdom when he gave his life up for love of the world and obedience to God, even for those who hated and persecuted him, and that willing surrender to abuse and to betrayal, that turning the other cheek that he admonishes us to do was meritorious. That God of course values that kind of self-sacrifice and rewards it, and he rewarded it in the case of Jesus. And the merit of Christ's offering is applied to us. It's applied to us principally through the sacramental mysteries through which we come to participate in the divine power of Christ, or die with him in baptism, or reborn with him. Again, I don't literally become an infant, not physically, right? Become like a little child, hopefully, if I'm doing it the right way, and then grow up to maturity with him in spirit. So that's the way the thing is applied to us. And the agency of the Holy Spirit, of course, animates the whole process, renders it supernaturally efficacious.
Appreciate your call, Dan. It is called a communion here on EWTN. John is watching us on YouTube right now. John says, I am, my family are semi-practicing Lutherans. I'm convinced of the real, literal presence of Christ in the Eucharist. Some of my family members say it's only a spiritual or even symbolic presence. I've tried charitably explaining how historically unorthodox that position is. My brother is really trying to wrap his mind around this doctrine. He has a pretty common objection, though, that I'm not sure how to answer. How is it not cannibalism? Thanks.
Yeah, sure. I appreciate it. Well, that's quite easy to answer, right? Because in cannibalism, what do you have to do to be a cannibal? Well, first of all, you have to kill a victim.
Yep.
Physically kill a victim, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or if you don't kill him, you know, prior, he'll be pretty much well and truly dead by the time you're done.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So he's dead. And then you're dividing his body parts up and literally masticating and digesting them so that they become incorporated into your body and his proteins become your proteins, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in the normal mode of digestion.
Mm-hmm.
None of that holds in the Eucharist. None of that holds in the Eucharist. First of all, in the Eucharist, Christ is not physically immolated or killed. He died only once. That was on Calvary, right? The immolation of Christ, the death of Christ, is represented to us in the Eucharist through the double consecration of bread and wine, but we're not actually killing him, right? So that's a major difference. And then we're not dividing and breaking him. So even in the fracture of the host, even in mastication and swallowing of the elements, Jesus' body is not divided so that I have like his head over here and his legs and arms over there. It doesn't work that way. I have the whole Christ, body, blood, soul, and divinity present in a mysterious mode, sacramental mode, under every single solitary particle of the host. And finally, Christ's proteins and fat cells and carbohydrates are not incorporated into my metabolism in the same way that, say, a tomato would be or a piece of flesh would be, because the real presence of Christ is only there for as long as the accidents or appearance of bread and wine remain. And so at some point, very soon, in the process of digestion, there's no more real presence of Christ even there. So what the elements that become assimilated to my body are no longer even Jesus at that point. So the analogy breaks down quite seriously, right? Yeah. So let's back it around and think about, well, you know, what is going on? Why do we believe in the real presence, and why is it so important? Well, first of all, we believe in the real presence because Christ taught it. And it's strange to me that Lutherans would deny this, because this is something that Martin Luther was willing to stake the Reformation on, in fact. In the Colloquy of Marburg, 1525, when Luther and the other major reformer at the time, Ulrich Zwingli, met in conference to see if they could make common cause against the Catholic Church, they agreed on almost all their points of doctrine, and they got around to the question of the Eucharist. And Luther had kind of sneakily written the words, "Hoc est corpus meum," this is my body, on dust in the table of the conference room, covered it up with a cloth, because he knew where Zwingli was going to go. He wanted to be ready.
Uh-huh.
And they got around to the Eucharist, and Zwingli puts out his symbolic ideas, and Luther rips the cloth off the table, points to the word, "Hoc est corpus meum," this is my body. He says, "That's what he said, that's what I believe, that's where I'm standing, I'm not budging." Now, Luther got a lot of things wrong. He got a lot of things wrong. But on the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, he was dead on right? He held to that point. And that has been that's like the major division between the Lutheran tradition and the Reformed tradition and the Anabaptist tradition in the 16th century Protestant movement. So the fact that a Lutheran would dissent from Luther and the Augsburg Confession just boggles the imagination. So you said they were semi-practicing.
Yeah.
Now, they're semi-believing Lutherans too,
apparently,
evidently,
so.
Right? So what's going on with this real presence of Christ in the Eucharist? Why bother? Well, first of all, and this Luther denied, right? This is critical. We have the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist so that it can be offered to God. Eucharist is a sacrifice that we offer to God. Prophet Malachi, chapter 1, prophesies that in the Messianic age, the Gentiles will make a pure offering to God. Well, that's the body and blood of Jesus that he makes available to us, leaves us a perpetual memorial of his death and resurrection that we can have that true worship in spirit and truth that the Father desires. And in doing so, of course, we conform our own lives to that sacrifice. We learn to be sacrificial people, giving of ourselves, uniting our pains and sufferings and joys and sorrows and prayers along with the sacrifice of Christ on the altar. And it's the worship in spirit and truth that is our spiritual act of worship. Secondly, the giving us his real body and blood in the Eucharist underlies to us the corporality of the redemption that we experience in Jesus. And we mentioned earlier on the show the doctrine of bodily resurrection, that it's not just our spirits that need saving, it's all of us that need saving.
Yeah.
And you know, so the logic of your argument, well, if it's just spirits that I'm worried about, then, you know, why even bother becoming incarnate? Right? Why even assume the second nature of the person of the Trinity, assume a human nature and become incarnate? Just send down some ushy cushy spiritual feelings and some spiritual teachings and off you go. No, but the Son of God became flesh and dwelt among us, made his dwelling among us, and gives us his body as the medicine of immortality, really highlighting that our salvation is a totality. It encompasses body and soul. And becomes, of course, the focal point of unity for the gathering of the church. Otherwise, we could just agree in spirit all the time and not actually get together.
Not good. All right, John, thank you so much for checking us out on YouTube. We really appreciate that. In a moment, we'll be talking to another Don in Trumbull, Connecticut. Also, Sean in Port Perry, Canada. Two lines open at the moment, 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion on this Monday afternoon here on EWTN. The Monday edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Thank you so much for joining us. Let's get right back to the phones and talk with Don in Trumbull, Connecticut, checking us out today on EWTN television. Hey, Don, what's on your mind today?
I'd like to know, is there any reference in the Bible
to Mary having children after Jesus was born?
Thank you. I appreciate the question. There is mention in the scripture that Christ had brothers and sisters. The nature of that fraternal relationship is not explicitly mentioned in the passages that speak of Christ's brothers and sisters. However, in other passages of the Bible, parallel texts, we learn what the relationship is. The Blessed Virgin had a cousin named Mary, the wife of Clopas. Mary, the wife of Clopas. And we learn from the Gospel of John that Mary, the wife of Clopas, is the mother of two of the men that are identified elsewhere as brothers of Jesus. So it's clear when you do the cross-references that the brothers of Christ are in fact biological cousins. And we use the term brother, you know, brethren, to mean family. And that's a convention that's still quite common in many parts of the world. Heck, I've got a buddy who thinks everybody is his brother.
Yeah.
And hey, brother, how you doing? and so that's what we have. So no evidence, because, of course, we know that she didn't, right, from Catholic teaching, from sacred tradition, and strongly implied by sacred scripture as well, that Blessed Virgin Mary is perpetually virgin, right? She never had sexual relations of any kind. Those who try to argue otherwise look at this one text out of context that mentioned the brothers of our Lord and assume they must have been Mary's children, although the text never says any such thing, and quite the contrary.
All right. Appreciate your call, Don. It is Called to Communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Sean now in Port Perry, Canada, checking us out on the Alexa device. Hey there, Sean. What's on your mind today?
Good afternoon, Tom. Hello, Dr. Anders. I'm curious about what we do in heaven. The only thing I can find that talks about any of activities that people in heaven do is wearing white robes, holding palm branches, and saying hallelujah or glory or something to effect. And yet I've heard elsewhere, and it may have been from another apologist on EWTN, that anyone we knew on earth who also gets to heaven, if we get there, then we will know them. So do we have a chance to talk to them, or do we just spend eternity praising God?
Okay, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So the most important thing to understand about the life of eternity for the blessed is the experience that the Church calls the beatific vision. And St. Paul, of course, speaks about this in 1 Corinthians 13, where he says, now we see as through a glass darkly, we see in part, we prophesy in part, we speak in part, but then we'll see clearly, we'll know fully, even as we're fully known, and we'll be like him when he appears. And so there's this transformative experience in grace where the deep, profound, comprehensive, intuitive knowledge of God is impressed into our souls in a supernatural manner. And we're talking about knowledge here, not just of propositions. You know, there's a lot of ways of knowing something. I can know about music theory and not know how to play the piano, right? I can know the chemical composition of a kiwi fruit, not know how one tastes. We're talking about all these kinds of knowing and more. A profound, experiential, intuitive knowledge of God as the infinite good, the infinite truth, and infinite beauty. And we have intimations of this experience in daily life. If you've ever read the poetry of Wordsworth, for example, and he writes about the intimations of immortality from early childhood, one of his most famous poems, where heaven lies about us, he says. And he sort of spends his whole life trying to get back to Pooh Corner, you know, to that sense of lost innocence and mystery and wonder that we all experience in the world in childhood, and which all the best poetry, and in my opinion, all the best stories are about. C.S. Lewis was a great master of evoking this sense of longing for the transcendent. And his essay On the Weight of Glory, he talks about trying to rip open that inconsolable secret that lies at the heart of everyone that we disguise and mutter up with language about romanticism, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, all the best stories, all the best myth, all the best philosophy, perennial philosophy, gets at that profound, transcendent longing for ultimate peace, ultimate fulfillment, ultimate truth, knowledge, desire to love and be loved in a way that satisfies every desire of mind and heart. That is what's given to us in the beatific vision, the life of heaven. Now, if we die right now and are blessed enough to get there, we will have that experience in a disembodied sense, right? If we get there before the resurrection from the dead. And so a disembodied spirit does not have eyes, does not have ears, does not have nose, mouth, feet, hands, can't play golf, can't talk, can't do anything, and so has this experience in a limited way. I mean, it's an infinite experience, but it's limited in extension just to the interiority of the soul. Now, when you get your resurrected body at the end of time, right, when Christ comes back, the body is raised, then you get your eyes, ears, nose, mouth, you know, hands and feet back. And now you add all, by extension, you add all this embodied activity to that profound intuitive knowledge of God, in which case social intercourse will be possible, right? And conversation and the recognition of friends and loved ones and walking about. And to be honest with you, beyond that, we don't know much. We don't know much, but we know that if you have a body, there's no point in having a body. It's impossible to have a body if you can't have local movement, right?
Yeah.
That's what it means to be a body. It means to be located spatiotemporally. And so there'll be something analogous to spatial temporal location and the ability to move and effect changes in that physical environment. And presumably to you know, cooperate with God in the ongoing work of co-creating the universe in an infinite array of creative wonder.
Sean, thank you so much for your call. It's Called to Communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Sylvia now. Sylvia is in Richfield, Washington, listening on the great Sacred Heart Radio. Hey, Sylvia, what's on your mind today?
My mind today is, well, first of all, I want to wish Tom a happy birthday.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you.
39 years old.
Okay. That's right.
Well, he's young. Okay, my question is, did I commit heresy because I partake communion with Protestant women at a tea party?
Hey, thanks. I appreciate the question. Heresy, no, because heresy is the crime of obstinately persisting in denying a dogma of the Catholic faith. And to the best of my knowledge, you didn't deny any dogmas of the Catholic faith, and you didn't do so obstinately. However, it was not good. All right, you should not partake of the putative sacraments of another religious communion, with a few very, very rare exceptions. Like if you're in danger of death and happen to be in an Eastern Orthodox country and can't get a hold of a Catholic priest, you could receive last rites from an Orthodox priest who has valid sacramental orders and apostolic succession. But no Protestant has that, or at least virtually none, except those maybe that left the Catholic faith. And so their sacraments are just putative sacraments. They're not real sacraments. And their communion does not contain the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus. And even if it did, which it doesn't, it would be offered schismatically in opposition to the unity of the one holy Catholic and apostolic church founded by Christ with its head, the successor of St. Peter, the Pope of Rome. So it contradicts in action, right, the fundamental unity of the Catholic Church, obedience to the Holy Roman Pontiff, and the doctrine of the real presence. So we ought not to be engaged in those kinds of performative contradictions and salute the flag of a foreign power, as it were.
Mm.
And so it was not done wisely, but my suspicion is the fact that you're asking the question meant you were unsure of yourself, probably didn't quite know what you were getting into, and so go easy on yourself. Don't beat yourself up about it. Go to confession, say, you know, I did this, I realize now I shouldn't have, thank you very much, and you'll be forgiven, and off you go.
Sylvia, thank you so much for your call. It's Called to Communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Evelyn now in New York, listening on EWTN television, a first-time caller. Hey there, Evelyn, what's on your mind today?
Oh, I'm so happy to get you online. Yes, I'm a Catholic that has been in and out of the Catholic Church, and I finally came back. But I sometimes watch other Protestant shows like CBN and all of those, and they always label the Catholic Church as a cult. Why do they do that? They put us down like with Jehovah's Witnesses and all these other Adventists and the Catholic Church. Can you explain that
to
me?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, thank you. So the origin of this belief, of course, goes all the way back to Martin Luther in the early 16th century. Luther became persuaded that the Pope was the Antichrist and the Roman Church the whore of Babylon. And, of course, he had to think that, right? He had to think that because otherwise he was a sinner for leaving it. And if the Church really was the one Church founded by Christ, you know, with this charism of infallibility and apostolic authority, then can't leave. Like, can't leave the Catholic Church. I mean, it's the one church. You can reform it. You can fix it. You can argue with it. You can get mad at it, but you can't leave it. Luther wanted to leave it. He wanted to set up his own church. And so he had to come up with a sufficient justification for doing that, so he made up his business about the Pope being the Antichrist. And Luther was a bit neurotic, well, more than a bit neurotic, and kind of narcissistic. And he used to wake up at night and kind of in a cold sweat and say, am I alone right? Just me? If I'm the only person that's got it right? And then he went, yeah, pretty much, and then went back to bed.
Wow.
Right? And you know what that kind of attitude leads to. And he had that kind of arrogant, you know, self-assurance that would lead him to throw the rest of the world into, you know, mm-hmm. to fire and blood and sword rather than admit that he was wrong. And that led to that kind of attitude of calling the other guy the Antichrist. And it got enshrined in doctrinal statements. So you read the original doctrinal statements of the 16th century. Westminster Confession, 17th century, teaches that the Pope is the Antichrist. This is part of Protestant belief and confession going back 500 years. And, of course, Protestants and Catholics differ on some pretty substantial issues. How we're saved is the biggest one. How yeah. we know the truth about Christ. We, of mm-hmm. course, believe what Jesus taught us about sacred tradition, and Protestants made up the doctrine of sola scriptura. We differ on our veneration of the Blessed Mother and all of the saints and life of the sacraments and the moral life. So there's some significant fundamental differences. But we don't think that they are a cult because they disagree with us. We think that Protestants have elements of truth and sanctification, in their tradition, but they've gotten some stuff substantially wrong. But we got enough in common that we can work together and we can pursue unity. But, you know, that doesn't necessarily get reciprocated. You know, on the other side, they don't necessarily go, oh, you got elements in truth and sanctification, and we're all Christians, we can work together. Some of them take that attitude. Some stick with Luther in the 16th century and say, no, the Pope is the Antichrist.
So, in summary there, we recommend stick with EWTN.
I would stick with EWTN. I wouldn't watch that stuff.
Yeah, and we're on the air 24 hours a day. Evelyn, thank you so much for your call. It's Called to Communion here on EWTN. I'll tell you something else that you can depend on as far as you know, factual content, and that is Catholic News Agency, CNA. It is absolutely free, and we bring great blogs to you, stories, opinions, and lots more to your fingertips anytime that you want. For the latest Catholic news, visit CatholicNewsAgency.com. It's an online service from EWTN News. A question now from Zita, watching us on Facebook today, David. Zita, this is a heartbreak, by the way. Zita says, I have a daughter who is in rehab, and now my son is hooked onto heroin. I was in his car yesterday and found a needle. I am so devastated because I am a devoted Catholic. My kids are baptized. All their sacraments were received in the church. Is this the cross I have to carry? And is this happening because of my sins?
Okay, thanks. Oh, man, my heart goes out to you. Mm-hmm. I really does. And I, you're suffering enormously, and I sense it. And we love you, and we're there with you. And I'm so sorry. In the 9th chapter of the Gospel of John, the disciples met a man born blind, and they turned to Jesus and they said, Master, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And Christ said, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but these things happened that the power of God might be made manifest among you, right? You know, we can influence our children, and we do, and we ought to, and we do our best to bring them up in the faith. We are in competition with a number of dark and evil forces.
Mm-hmm.
We are in competition with their own fallen, wounded nature. We are in competition with the power of the evil one. We are in competition with a very powerful and influential culture that hates the life of virtue and hates temperance and hates the life of meaning and is nihilistic and feeds us a nonstop barrage of visual images of sensuality. We're in competition with the alienation of peers, with peer pressure, sometimes with the wounds of broken families. These things are powerful, powerful forces that mitigate against the truth of the sacraments or their efficacy in our lives. And your complaint, unfortunately, is an increasingly common one, even among those who are faithful, devout, and virtuous parents. We cannot control our children. It is not a possibility. We may influence them, but we are not the only influences.
Yeah.
And they are morally responsible human beings. And this is, unfortunately, a scourge, as you know. This addiction business is a scourge that is ravaging the country and the world. And it does flow, I believe, in part from a crisis of meaning that also pervades the country. And you say, well, the Catholic faith should satisfy that desire for meaning, and you're correct. You're absolutely right. The problem is the Catholic faith is in competition with many, many options that come with many more sounds and lights. You know, many more sounds and lights. Mm-hmm. When you take your children to Mass, and maybe the priest has got a cold, maybe he's got a bad accent, maybe he's not a great preacher, you know, the delivery mechanism, if you will, of the Catholic faith is inefficient. We have this tremendous tradition of transcendent wisdom. It's hard to assimilate. There has to be a willingness on the participant to receive what's being offered, and sometimes a lot of effort has to go into it.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, I can flip on Netflix or Amazon Prime or the television or iTunes or whatever, and I can get fed, you know, the offer of nonstop transcendence, you know, in skimpy clothing for a dime. And also what my friends do, and they think it's great. And that's a powerful temptation. And then when you're confronted with all this multitude of options out there, well, then the possibility of relativism occurs to you. Well, how do I know the Catholic faith's the right one? Here are all these other alternatives, and they seem similar. And then you find yourself just falling into that pit of nihilism and despair and relativism, for which there is no life has no meaning other than what I make of it, and nothing seems to satisfy. And then we turn to drugs.
Wow. Zita, thank you so much, and we will certainly keep you in our prayers as well, along with your family. It's Call to Communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Juanita now. Juanita's in Omaha, listening on EWTN television. Hey, Juanita, what's on your mind today?
Well, happy birthday, number to the person I missed.
Thank you.
I was wondering, I got married, and the father of my five kids passed away. I remarried a man, and it took me 30 years to figure out he was a pedophile, and he abused three of my children. Now, is that grounds for divorce?
Yes. 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 You need to... My heart's breaking. Juanita, there's so much going on here. I really strongly encourage you to seek the protection that you need, have recourse to the civil government, and if you have to have recourse to the family court and divorce court and so forth in order to seek that protection, then that may be the step that you have to take. I would absolutely contact your local church and the marriage tribunal of your diocese, and I think that having a declaration of nullity and annulment in this situation would probably be a slam dunk case and would happen fairly quickly. And I think that I really would encourage you to reach out to Catholic Family Services in your diocese and receive some counseling and some help and some therapy, because you've been traumatized. And I can't even imagine what you must be experiencing, and your children too. And I have permission to say this, by the way, right? I have permission to say this. If you don't have the help that you need where you are, you can call Catholic Family Services in my diocese of Birmingham, Alabama. I was actually, the director told me to make that offer on the radio.
Oh, wow.
And they can help you arrange for teleconferencing with a Catholic counselor. And I would have an appointment and talk to a priest as well, and receive some pastoral care, because this is a big deal, and you and your family have been through the ringer, and y'all have been deeply wounded, and the church is there to help you.
God bless you, Juanita. Thank you so much for your call. Here is Dennis now in Ontario, listening on EWTN television. Hey, Dennis, what's on your mind today?
Yes, I just want to know how powerful St. Michael is.
Well, he's on the winning side. He is on the winning side. He is the general you know, leading the troops into battle, so to speak, for King Jesus, and he's also going to be on the mop-up team, you know, at the end of time. So St. Michael, defend us in battle.
Can't go wrong with St. Michael. Appreciate your call, Dennis. Here is Luke now on EWTN's Call to Communion in Kearney, Nebraska, checking us out today on Spirit Catholic Radio. Hey, Luke, what's on your mind today?
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. So I am an Eastern Orthodox Christian with a great admiration for the Catholic Church. So, of course, I'm interested in the dialogues that have been going on mm-hmm. in the past few decades. And in 2003, the North American Orthodox Catholic Consultation published a document on the Filioque controversy in which one of their contentions, or assertions anyway, was that a great deal of the controversy was over the two words for procession in Greek and Latin. So that the Greek word is more precise. When it says to proceed, it means like from a particular source, like as it's like a river comes from a spring or something, whereas the Latin word processio is more general, meaning like just to move forward from. So their assertion is that like a better understanding of these words helps to resolve the controversy, because the Catholic Church, in inserting the Filioque, really wasn't saying that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father, proceeds from the Son as from like his origin, that the Holy Spirit's ultimate origin is still only in the Father, and that can be understood from the Catholic perspective. So I was curious if like this particular resolution of the Filioque controversy is something that can be generally accepted in like mainstream Catholic theological thought, or rather this is more of like a kind of a wishful thinking among like ecumenists.
Okay, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So one of the best analysis of this and related questions is the book Rome and the Eastern Churches by the Dominican theologian Aidan Nichols. Nichols' assessment of the Filioque as a source of disunity between East and West is that the theological dialogue has proceeded to the point where we're now mainly semantic in our differences in our understanding of the Trinity. And so this is, whether the analysis that you've given is the only way through the dilemma or not, I'm not going to say that. Is that a way through? Yes. And, I mean, this seems to be the consensus of theologians from both sides that are examining this question. Now, you know, this is not my specialty, but I will tell you that St. Thomas Aquinas, who, of course, is the premier theologian of the Catholic tradition, specifically identifies the Father as the principio, the source of the Blessed Trinity. And there's a twofold procession in God, right? Internal to the Godhead. And there is a primacy of, by way of procession, to the Father relative to the Spirit and the Son. So I'm framing that slightly differently than the language that you've used, but it seems to be an analogous distinction. So, I hadn't read the document that you're referencing, and I'd want to go read it in more depth to pronounce more precisely. But it seems good to me, I guess, is basically the sum of the thing.
Yeah.
Now, you know, there are other questions that come out of the Filioque other than the metaphysics, other than the ontology. There's the question of religious authority and whether the Pope can promulgate a profession of faith absent an ecumenical council and these sorts of issues, which I really think was at the heart of the controversy back in the days of Photius. I mean, I think it had as much to do with ecclesiology as it did with ontology. And that's where I think the real struggle is going to be, how to conceive of, how to express and celebrate the primacy of the Bishop of Rome and universal jurisdiction in a way that is respectful of the Eastern patrimony and certain measure of autonomy. And so far, the Eastern churches have not thought that the way of the sui juris churches in the Latin Church, the Catholic Church, is a sufficient recognition of their autonomy. So that's the $64 question right there.
It is fascinating, and big props to St. John Paul for really, bringing the conversation to the fore. I think he's done a wonderful service for all of mankind, don't you?
There you go, asking me to comment when here comes the music. But Ut Unum Sent, his encyclical, of course, on ecumenism, actually says, let's look to the first 1,000 years.
Yeah. Good stuff. Hey, Luke, thank you so much for your call. We could not get to Brian in Boston, couldn't get to Jose in Texas. If you folks would call us back tomorrow or any day of your choice, we'll put you at the head of the line, I promise. Also, a couple of texts that we couldn't get to, and we'll carry those over for a future program. Dr. David Anders, thank you, sir.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
We do the program Monday through Friday here on EWTN Radio, 2 p.m. Eastern is the time. And we also bring you that same show at 11 p.m. Eastern and a best-of show on Sundays at 2 p.m. Eastern, along with the program being available 24/7 online at EWTNradio.net. On behalf of Charles, Michael, and Jeff, I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders. See you tomorrow on Call to Communion. God bless.